You're listening to Fusion Patrol, a listener-supported podcast. Each week, we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series, movie, or audio and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Kenneth.
And tonight we are looking at episode 12 of Space Above and Beyond. Who monitors the birds? Now, before I get into my episode synopsis, I want to say that this is a almost silent episode of television. Many people have likened it to a bold and daring experiment that's one of the finest things they've ever seen on television. And because of how creative and how daring it was for them to do a 45 plus minute episode with only 2 minutes worth of dialogue in the entire episode. And that inspired me to be creative with my synopsis. So, I think I still cover all the important parts, but I have, I've taken to the fact that Tank is 6 years old and I've run with it. Okay.
Okay.
Episode synopsis. Sea Tank born. Sea Tank indoctrinated. Sea Tank ask questions. Sea Tank marked for death. Sea Tank kill. Sea Tank run. Run Tank run. Sea Tank recruited for assassination. Sea Tank on planet. Sea Chigs on planet. Look Tank, look. There are Chigs. Sea Tank kill. Kill Tank kill. Sea Tank run. Run Tank run. Okay. So,
obviously you have read the Dick and Jane books.
Indeed I have, and I would have been about the right age, about Tank's age.
Yep.
When I was introduced to those, and that leads me to a fascinating question, is how the heck, at 8 months, do they know how to read?
That's a good question.
I thought going into this episode I was not going to have anything to say. Then yeah, I started thinking about what we saw. And then I'm like, oh yeah, this raises so many questions that just don't have good answers. But let me start with it. Did you enjoy the episode? What did you think of the episode?
I had to watch it twice and read a synopsis to find out what was going on.
I'm so sorry you had to watch that twice. Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna start right off. I'll start off with that. That is my lead point. I had no clue what was going on. And I don't mean that in terms of I couldn't follow what I was seeing on the screen, but my synopsis doesn't necessarily do justice. 40 minutes of this episode is nothing but Tank in heavy camo by himself on a planet full of Chigs, killing Chigs and trying to reach an extraction point and getting out completely wordlessly. It is 30 minutes of well shot and well realized in terms of I know exactly what's going on without there being dialogue. It's totally unnecessary. So in that respect, but it was 35 minutes in this episode before I realized the guy I was watching was Tank.
The haircut was not his standard haircut.
The haircut and the camo just threw me. And the fact that they were using two sets of flashbacks, or three, if you wish. There's a flashback to when Tank was born in 2257, I think it was. And there's a flashback to when Tank was being indoctrinated at age 8 months. And then there was flashback to when Tank was being recruited for this particular mission. And they were not properly... They were framed in such a way that if you couldn't identify Tank as the guy on the planet, which I couldn't, honestly couldn't. I mean, of course, this is, you know, higher generic looking guy with no actual distinctive facial features. Give him a different haircut, cover him in camo paint, and don't let him speak. Well, how the heck was I supposed to know? Because you're in flashback. You know, we see this guy on the island, and then suddenly, or on the planet, and then suddenly we're shown a scene where a colonel comes in and recruits Tank for a special mission on a planet. And you kind of think, well, is he recruiting him with something to do with this other mission? And at some point, he's going to meet up with this guy on the planet. And so my brain is following this as two different threads that are going to meet later in the episode. And they don't. because they aren't.
Yeah.
And when I finally got it, that it was Tank. And I honestly, when I got to the end of the episode, it was when he tears up the honorable discharge that I'm going, oh, I kind of was like, at some points I go, is that, yeah. But when he tore that up, I'm like, is that, well, no, I don't think, yeah, maybe, oh, you know, well, but maybe this is another guy who was also offered an honorable discharge to go on this. Oh, the episode's over. Well, that must have been Tank. I think I'm going to look that up online. I'm definitely going to look this one up online because I don't want to go in. I don't mind admitting that the episode threw me and that I was just completely disengaged from the fighting because I don't care. You know, you could give me, I wouldn't give you money for any amount of combat footage in this world of that type of guys on the ground shoot each other in the head. Just don't care.
Yeah.
And so, not really engaged with that storyline. I'm just sitting here waiting for, well, when's the story going to begin? And then we get to the end of it, and oh, it's over. And I looked online, and that's when I found that people were just, to put it delicately, I think, having to change their underwear because of how orgasmic they found this episode to be, and bold and daring and incredible piece of television. And I'm just like, it's a confusing piece of television that most of it I could have thrown away.
Yeah, I read
but
a
on the
similar
flip side, there is some interesting things in it. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
There are. I read a similar review at the movie blog, which has a complete guide to the series. And the author of that post was fawning all over it.
And I saw several. Yeah.
On the other hand, he did explain the episode to me, so.
Well, that's why I went.
Thanks for that.
I do explain it for sure. Because, there's a couple things that happened in this episode that were that threw me off. And I'll give you one. Early in the episode on the planet, somebody named John Colquitt is killed.
Yeah.
He's one of the two guys that's on this planet. And they're obviously high skill, like SEAL-type commando sort of things, right? They're on an infiltration mission, two guys, and this guy, Colquitt, is killed, and the other guy, who turns out is Tank, but the other guy, who I cannot identify at the time, takes his dog tags, and you see John Colquitt. And like, okay. Then within moments, we see a colonel or a general named Colquitt, an old man with a mustache, and he's way too stinking old to be going on field missions. Way too old enough to have a son who is old enough to go on field missions like this, and he's recruiting Tank to go on a mission. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, he says it's an assassination mission, but at the same time, I have a feeling that he's going in because his son was on that planet and his son got killed, and that was the Colquitt we saw killed moments ago. Again, because of the time shifts and not giving us anything to go on, I did not realize that this is the guy who got killed. Because he's just too damn old to have been the guy out there. Like, absurdly ridiculous idea that was him. And so that was a casting mistake, which apparently the guy they cast is somebody that Morgan and Wong love to cast. Well, they should not have done that in this episode.
His name was Dale Dye.
Dale Dye. Apparently, they cast him a lot.
Yes.
And he's the wrong guy.
Yes. And before I watched this episode, I wrote out the entire cast list. So I knew that it was him on the planet because I'd written out the cast list first. But I take your point that he was too old to be there.
It's such a cliche that the military guy whose son goes on a mission, he does something a little off the books to go in and try to, I don't know, rescue his son's body. I mean, it's not like we didn't see that earlier in an episode of this very series.
Ray Butts.
With Dwayne Dwibley or whatever. Yeah, Ray Butts. And it's a trope they've already gone to the well with, and it wouldn't have surprised me at all. And I thought that's what it was. You know,
yeah, I wonder speaking of retrieving corpses, I wonder if, or at least burying them, what's going to happen to Colquitt's corpse?
Yeah, I couldn't even tell for sure if he buried him or just half buried him or,
Yeah.
I don't know, left him for the big bird things, the pterodactyls.
Yeah.
I don't
Yes.
know.
And speaking of this name, John Colquitt, Morgan and Wong have an association with the X-Files. Jack Colquitt was the alter ego of the cigarette-smoking man.
Yeah, they've used that name before too. So it's apparently they like that name. It's not really a good name,
Yes,
frankly.
I
It's
also yes, yeah. I also noticed a chronological error
Oh yeah. But
in this
okay.
episode because I froze the image on that screen that had Hawks's information on it.
Right. He's got his birthday and stuff there, yeah.
His birth date is May 15th, 2053, but he's
Yep.
8 months old in on New Year's Day, 2058, and he's 6 years old in 2064.
No, it's definitely wrong. It was definitely wrong. I saw that on the screens in the flight. These numbers don't add up. But you know, I'm gonna take it as read in the opening sequence where it says, you know, today is January 1st, 2058. You have been alive 8 months,
Yes.
which I think would be
The end of
April.
April.
Yeah,
Be in April.
it would actually be April, but yeah, okay, approximately eight. I mean, I think they're being a little what's the
Round
word for it? Loose
number-ish.
with the truth, loose with the
Yes.
truth in that.
Well, those
So,
well I would yeah, that would fit when I read all those slides.
yeah.
Like with pithy sayings such as to be monitored is to be free. Spared the agony of decision.
Yeah,
Yeah, go ahead.
let me read them. I put them down so we could include them in the show here.
Yes, go
Exactly
ahead.
what it says in the year 2058 on the old slide projector shooting up on the screen, you know, when they're not looking at their fancy LCD watches. But it says in a ridiculous style. It is like you set a group of people down in a room and then you flash slides at them that just have a line of text on it. So each one of these is a single line of text. Good morning. Today is January 1st, 2058. Happy New Year. You have been alive 8 months. The monitors are pleased with you. To be monitored is to be free. Spared the agony of decision. Released from the burden of choice. In vitros need only react. To react how America wants you to react. America loves you. One day, you will return her love and defeat those trying to harm her. Terrorists, silicates, subversives. Today's lesson will now begin. There are 687 methods of killing a human being. Method number one, and then we won't go on. But so, yeah, it's really. And this is, you know, this is what actually is interesting about this episode. The combat stuff on the planet, very little to report there. But getting a glimpse at Tank's birth indoctrination, how he got out, sort of why he was arrested, but we can talk about this. And I think you will see in those fawning reviews that it is incredible how well they've tied this up together with this amazing backstory that fits everything we've seen, except that it doesn't. But you know, I think you see what you want to see, and maybe I don't want to see much good in this. I didn't enjoy it. Why should I see good in it? I don't know. But
It sounds to me like something out of George Orwell or Aldous Huxley.
oh, absolutely, absolutely, and I'm sure that's what they're going for. But so, looking at his existence, we see him born. We see him at this thing, being shown pictures. And even there, I was kind of bouncing back and forth, even though he wasn't done up in the paint. I'm like, I think that's Tank. I'm pretty sure that's Tank, but I'm not 100% sure that's Tank because, again, maybe this is the guy on the planet and they're showing me his indoctrination to be a killer as to why he's so good at being a killer. I'm not 100%, but at some point, then that one I got, it's like, oh, no, that's Tank. Okay, we definitely got that one was Tank. He's he you know, in their dorm at night, he looks out, during the day. I forget which it was. And he sees a bird. Bird. And he gets all wistful. And then during this session, he raises his hand, which, you know, appears to be totally out of character for the in vitros. And they're like, what is it? He goes, who monitors the birds? And the monitors are like, well, we monitor the birds. And then he goes, well, who monitors the monitors? And then they, you know, put notes in his permanent file and they're going to have him killed because he's defective, because he asks questions.
Have him erased. The actual language erased, yes.
Yeah, you know, we should mention their euphemistic term for murder. But yeah, it's murder. And one of the fellow in vitros apparently overheard that, gives him a note. And so when they take him off to kill him, he kills the guy doing the work and he escapes out into the world. Okay. So now we know Tank's backstory. He's a known murderer that is identified and is absolutely lined up. And how did he survive 6 years out in the wild?
Get arrested when
he got in, ran afoul of some punks in the street. And then they sent him to fight. Would they have really done that for a murderer? Or would they have sent him off to be erased at that point? It's like, well, you know, your erasure is overdue, so off you go. On the other hand, he is a trained killer.
So I can see
he only got to day one, apparently, before he... The hand. Day one, the hand. It's like Monty Python. Day one, the larch. It's how to kill a man from quite a far way away with a larch. Yeah. I don't think it makes a good case for what's going on. I think the timelines just don't justify. And sure, the whole thing with the in vitros is fascinating, except that they are emotionally stunted killers, all of them, right? We're now looking at this program as that they're just bred to be emotionally stunted killers. But in the world we're in, they're being sent out as colonists. And they're living on the streets, and having jobs, and there's affirmative action. And like, that's all fine and dandy, but these are emotionally stunted killers.
Yes, they're intended for military service.
This does not, it's totally unfair, and it's totally wrong, but you cannot let those people go. You can't. Can't do it. And I don't care how liberal you are about, oh, what a terrible life they've had. It's like, no, it's like they are defective in societal terms. They are probably sociopathic. Well, we've seen
they are that way. They're that way by design.
By design.
They're that way by training.
And you don't just say, well, that was a mistake. Let them go. You have to do something. You have to fix that somehow. You have to put them in therapy as long as it takes or not just... Well, we're going to integrate them in society and send them out to the colonies and stuff. It's like, no, this is, you have not thought the whole in vitro thing through. And if the in vitros have all been born and bred and raised to kill, how come there's only two in the military?
I thought about that too. And I suppose, and how do we explain McQueen, who is obviously a sympathetic and well-developed character? As far as characters go, he's not...
Presumably, he was a defect.
Yes, he is not psychopathic. He's not sociopathic.
Oh, I don't even mean that. I mean the tank-type defect, where presumably he did not escape from his training facility. Presumably, he went through tank training and came out the other end. So he's a fully formed killer, whereas Tank is just the sort of... I dropped out on day one of death school. That whole thing just does not work.
Yes, a few episodes back, when Hoss explained that he ran away from in vitro school, I imagined him as having been there for a few years.
He may have been there 8 months because he at least learned to read.
Yes.
Which, again, how? I mean, I'm not buying the whole Tarzan thing, right? You raise a kid with the wolves until he's 15, 20, whatever Tarzan was, he doesn't learn to speak English. That is, you know, or he does not learn to speak it well, because you have passed the developmental years of brain formation. And
yes,
these guys never even get that. they come out fully brain formed. It's like, well, I'm just not convinced that you could teach them to read and write and hold a fork. It seems like, you know, it's like when you show those shows where you have a clone and the clone is a full adult and it has all the memories of the other one. It's like, it doesn't work that way.
No.
It can't work that way.
What are little girls made of? Star Trek season one.
Well, they transferred mental engrams into robots, but where do they get the mental engrams to transfer into these guys?
Yeah.
And if they did, why bother to send them to school? Why do they need to go to 687 ways to kill human school? Why don't you just pump that into their brain to begin with?
Yeah, it's like, do you remember Demolition Man?
They did? It's been a very long time. But yeah.
Where the prisoners served their sentences in tanks. And everybody had a certain got to learn something, or just something fed into the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're talking about a movie from 1993.
Yeah. And they could do that, but they need to explain it. And because all they ever show us is them sitting in classrooms, you'd be right in thinking that this is how they're teaching them.
Yes.
Not some sort of high-tech, tied to their LCD watch. That cracked me up. It's like, oh, look at that high-tech watch he's got. Woo, it's an antique. In his year.
Well, it's also the episode obviously predates PowerPoint.
Or digital. Yeah. Any kind of digital presentation media. Yeah. But it doesn't, though, because the program started in the year 2027. So look out 4 years from now. We're going to start the in vitro. So they'll, where are the silicates? Yeah.
I did have one big unanswered question.
Okay.
From this episode. And did Hawk succeed in his mission?
I thought your one unanswered question would be, why? But my understanding is, and this is truly based on stuff that I had to see afterwards, but I think it fits the... what we saw on screen is that, yes, he did. That they killed a guy, and that's why when we first see them, the first thing they're doing is looking for extraction. Mission accomplished, time to get out. So, yes, I think they did accomplish it, and I think it's irrelevant to the story as told. I mean, there's a lot of things that, maybe that was relevant to the story, but yeah, I think so. I think so, and I think that's the general consensus online. But again, I couldn't figure that out till after it was over because I didn't know what was going on with that mission because I didn't know it was Tank.
It's like,
these guys are trying to infiltrate and they're looking for their extraction. So I guess the answer is they're either stranded on the planet and they're trying to get out, or they've gotten in, done their job, and they're trying to get out. So.
Okay.
But again, it does. You certainly could get the feeling for when you see two guys come out of the water in scuba gear, you could think they're doing the infiltration right now, that they're heading for somewhere to get in. It gives that illusion. It does not give the illusion that they are running away from the job. And considering that he spends all his time running away from the water, and then to get out, he goes back to the water, gets in the scuba gear, and goes back off, you could also be work on the assumption that they did get onto the planet, and they just never got anywhere close. Colquitt got killed quickly, and they just... maybe they were looking at the extraction point by saying, how much time do we have that we can get in and get out? I genuinely don't know. But he had the... Of course, the other people are also interpreting the fact that the idiot Tank, at the end, this is a scuba gear, and he pulls out his honorable discharge that he's been promised for going on this assassination mission, and he tears it up. Now, if he did kill the guy, he succeeded. He could get out of the army. People are going, it's because they're the only family he's got. And that's one of the few lines in the dialogue. That's his family. So why would he want to leave? It's literally the only family he's ever had. So I can kind of see that. On the other hand, you could interpret it as like, well, we didn't kill the guy, so I don't deserve this.
So yeah, the episode doesn't explain it. And anything we read in something somebody wrote online is purely an interpretation of what we saw on the screen.
Right. And I'm willing to accept anybody's reasoned argument as to why, like, for example, because they start off with the extractions, I could see making the case that they're on the way out. But then on the other hand, because they came in and they left by way of scuba gear, I could see the argument that they did not make it. So I'll take arguments, and maybe you've got a compelling one that can't be, but I don't know. I think anything, you know, it's headcanon. If you're doing it because he loves to fight in 58 because they're his family, you're just projecting, you know. And if Morgan and Wong say that's the way it was, then I will make,
yes, sir.
I'll make the argument I've said many times before. I will take that in as a point in its favor, and I will go, okay, I can accept that interpretation, but it's not as clear-cut as perhaps you thought it was.
Right.
You know? And if they did something that made you go, well, you've contradicted that, you've literally contradicted that in the episode, then that's a different, you know, something. I think you're wrong. I think maybe you did it, but you just did it incompetently, perhaps. But, you know.
Right. Yes. And speaking of points I had to look up online, the Whore of Death.
is that the one you saw the name for Vanson in her unpleasant garb?
Yeah, and makeup.
Yeah, I've got a note on that too. It's like, Tank, get some therapy, dude.
Yeah, but apparently, in writings about combat,
this combat or combat in
or just
general?
Combat in general, this okay. figure, this. This figure now called the Whore of Death keeps recurring.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And male soldiers keep seeing this figure.
Okay.
And so this episode goes back to that figure.
I mean, I interpreted
But I didn't know that until I looked it up, because I haven't read any of the writings about combat.
I've never heard of it. I mean, in as used in this episode, it presents a sort of, in a way, there's a sort of fatalism there. It does seem to represent the specter of death. So Tank, seeing that, is seeing death. And, you know, at many points during the course of this, he is pretty darn close to being killed. The odds are overwhelmingly against him. But it could also be interpreted, and I think it is, I think it's fair, that he's got, what's a delicate way to put this? A certain physical attraction to Vanson.
Undoubtedly.
Which, you know, when she was the only one he really kind of lingered over and looked at in her bed as he was sneaking out, because it's a top secret mission, you know, that ties with that. And what it did was it's in his imagination. So at times he's sitting there and suddenly it appears and it grabs him by the head and it forces his head to look to the left and there are chicks coming. And it forces him to look to the right and there are chicks coming. And then the illusion ends and he looks to the left and he looks to the right and there are indeed chicks exactly where he thought he was coming. So there is, Vanson is the person who keeps me alive. Vanson's looking out for me. Vanson's going to force me to stay alive. That happens a couple of times, not that exact motion, but in both instances, this figure alerts him to something he should be aware of that will kill him if he does not know about it. So, and then also gives him a golden eye dance there. I cannot think of what's her name. Anya Top. Her thigh-crushing dance in one of those.
Yeah, I remember that movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a way, I guess, to get another actor in there. Sorry, we had to give somebody some lies. But, you know, apparently Morgan and Wong had heard of the Whore of Death and wanted to work it into the story. Okay. You know, why not? In a way, I'm fine with that. If that's a thing that is in the zeitgeist of combat, never heard of it, but okay, sure, why not? This is how we learn these things.
Okay, I wondered about if the choice of director had anything to do with the topic of the episode, because the director was Wienrich Kolbe.
Yep.
Who was a combat veteran, from the Vietnam War.
I don't know. I mean, that name is, I knew that name when I saw it. I'm sure he's done Babylon 5 and Star Trek.
Actually, I did write down his credits. He did not do Babylon 5.
He definitely did Star Trek.
He directed 16 episodes of The Next Generation, 13 episodes of Deep Space Nine, 18 episodes of Voyager, and one of Enterprise.
Yeah, it's a name I've heard a lot. So, you know,
did they pick him because he's a vet or because he does a lot of sci-fi? Maybe both, but this one, because maybe the combat experience would have helped. I don't know, just a stray thought. He also directed episode 17 of Space Above and Beyond. We'll consider that when we get to it. He directed one episode of War of the Worlds. Thought you'd like that one. And
oh boy,
he directed...
Which one?
I didn't write down the title, but...
That's all right.
Okay. He also directed Baltar's Escape.
Oh, God. I assume even from the classic episode, I don't know if there's a...
Baltar's Escape in the
new series, but yeah, okay.
For the classic Battlestar Galactica.
That's going back a ways, then.
Yes.
You know, that's another 10, 15 years before this.
Yes, and I just wrote down the science fiction credits.
Mm-hmm.
He's directed in various television genres.
Veteran director, absolutely.
Yes.
Veteran director, and, you know, who knows? Who knows why they picked him, but he did well. He dealt well with the combat because I was, yeah. You know, it was clear what was going on. It wasn't clear who was going on, but it was clear what was going on. And it was, you know, well tense when it needed to be. It never devolved into what the heck's going on at any point, So in that respect, very competently done, given, you know, what he was given. Just, you know, some time to kill, basically. Let's see. The whole thing about the I do want to come back to something about the indoctrination of the tanks, but there is a sequence on the planet where Tank sees a bird. Looks more like a pterodactyl, but, you know, it's an alien bird. A few minutes later, a chig. He sees a chig. The chig sees the bird. He's about to shoot the chig in the back of the head, you know, as you do. And the chig stops and looks up at the bird and ponders it. And he feels the kindred spirit there. And he doesn't shoot him.
He
lets him go. Oddly enough, later on, he's in a situation where he's taken out a bunch of chigs with a knife, I think, at this point. And he takes this one down off of a hill. And it basically pleads for its life.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah, raises a hand. It's like, you know, don't kill me. And Tank hesitates. And then the chig hands him that little thing that's on their uniform or on the front of their metal plate that we saw in one of the other episodes. I don't remember what it was. Must have been the first one that they met on Mars or whatever. But anyway, hands them that little semicircular magnetic piece. And Tank hands him his ring. And then tells him to go, and the chig runs away, and he runs away. And then later he kills him anyway, because they all look alike, and he walked into a trap. They were still looking for him, and he killed him, so he took his ring back and gave him his thing back. Because we got to understand, the chigs are just like us in the travesty of war. Oh, except that they're not, and this bugs me about this show. We've discussed it before, but hit it again. Why are the chigs taking over planets they cannot live on?
I don't understand it myself.
Right?
It's
you
like,
would
choose,
think this galaxy was big enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pick different planets. We don't
choose
want those
ecosystem.
Planets.
Choose an ecosystem that suits you.
We'll choose ours. You choose yours. We won't bother each other. This did not have to devolve into this. We were taking over a planet suitable for our life form, and it's not even suitable for you, we've now learned, and yet you attack them and take it back. And it's like, now I'm gonna go way off into the depths here.
Okay.
John Wyndham, The Kraken Awakes. Have you ever read it?
No.
I wish they had made this John Wyndham Day of the Triffids, case Midwich Cuckoos. But The Kraken Awakes, or The Kraken Awakes, depending on your particular dialect, is another one of his books. So, spoilers for a novel from the 50s. The Kraken Awakes is about an invasion of Earth by aliens from a planet, probably one in our solar system like Saturn or Jupiter, where they exist at the bottom of an extremely deep pressure well. And they arrive in our oceans and go straight to the deep trenches. And we exist with them on the planet for many years, actually, because they can't come up to our domain. They burst, and we can't send anything down to theirs. And efforts like to send bathyspheres down are destroyed. But eventually, you know, they start, terraforming is the wrong word, but in other words, they start great construction works down there. They start building underwater tunnels, and they start churning up tons of gunk that's polluting the waters. And they also start sending fishing expeditions to the surface. They send up things that capture and catch people and animals that live along coastal waters and drag them back down to the bottom, where presumably they use them for food. And just like we send deep sea fishing, and they, you know, eventually are changing the planet and altering the ice caps and things like that are causing problems for mankind. And they are far, far more advanced than us. But the point is, they're not really directly mucking about with the surface. And yeah, they're doing forays for food, but by and large, they're in their world, we're in our world, and eventually conflict occurs. But this is what I see for this. This would make far more sense. I would love them to make The Kraken Awakes as a movie, because it's so different from the usual invasion type story. But I see that here. Sure, we might come into conflict with them, but there needs to be a reason for it. And
right,
there isn't one. And they are so out of their environment. They're fighting on our terms, really, by being in our biospheres. And that is not a sustainable, it is not a sustainable fight. It doesn't make any sense. And I need, and here's another one. And this is a cliche, because these guys just do cliches. This show is a cliche. It is a war movie cliche. And, you know, we've got Colquitt to tank. We've got intelligence that a high-ranking officer who was probably the officer who was in charge of the Vesta colony, whatever it was, massacre.
Vesta.
Is going to be on this planet. And so our job is to go in to assassinate him. Where the heck could you possibly get intelligence like that? You don't speak their language. You can't possibly have any spies in their
network.
And
how do you know who it is? Because they all look alike in that armor.
Yeah, I mean, there's just all sorts of questions. But, you know, the trope is that during World War II, we had people, German Americans or sympathetic Germans, who were working inside Germany. And we had some Japanese Americans that we hadn't locked up in internment camps. Thank you, America, for your stellar human rights record, who were working in the war effort against the Japanese, and that they could be spies and that could get into Imperial command or could operate on the streets of Japan and not be instantly identified as a foreign agent. Not possible in this scenario. And yet they're treating it just like, oh, it's just an ordinary war film and we've got spies and we've got intelligence. Like, no. You can't even speak the same language. You don't understand their language. There's no evidence that they understand, that we understand their language on this. And I use the word we as in humans, but...
Right.
And that's where this is falling apart for me. It's like, and why are we fighting a ground war? Why are we fighting with troops on the ground? That makes no sense either.
Especially on planets they can't hold or live on. And I, this should be space battles in a space war.
Yeah, I mean, or bombing the planets, or, you know, carpet bombing, or it's just, it isn't a troops on the ground kind of war, and it doesn't really seem like they've got objectives that are worthy of sending in the troops. You know, they're sending in a platoon here, a platoon there. It's like, this is not the invasion of Normandy. This is not throw it all. This is just like little strategic strikes on single. But it just doesn't make any sense. The show doesn't make any sense from that standpoint. And so here's my last point here. You're welcome to have more points, but I'm going to get my points out because I have a surprising amount of notes for this. I've mentioned this before. I certainly mentioned it during Star Hunter Redux. I don't like Percy. I don't like Dante. I don't want them to succeed because I don't care. And in the case of Percy, I actively dislike her. And I've mentioned it on this show. I don't really like our cast of characters. It's not that I have anything against the actors. It's not that I have anything against the cast or anything. It's just, I don't like these people. I don't like why they're in the military, because they're in the military. But I mean, I can't sympathize with that. Tank's the only one that I can sympathize with, because he's just stuck with it. The others all joined to go kill some jigs. And, you know, and like Damp House has actual real skills that should be useful elsewhere. Right? I mean,
good point.
This is don't send your nuclear engineers off to be fighter pilots. That's dumb. Like, you know, that's like, West, he's nothing, but send him off to get killed. But not, you know, not Damp House. So I haven't got any sympathy for these characters. And then we abstract this back a level, and we see more of it in this episode, but we've seen it before. The government of the United States is corrupt. The government of the world is corrupt. The government of America, let's call it America instead of the United States, because they call it America. The government of America creates and breeds slaves and indoctrinates them to be killers. I don't want them to win this war. And if I didn't think that the Chigs were religious fanatics waging a war on a fatwa or something, then, you know, I don't want them to win either. This is like showing me a film where I'm supposed to root between the Ayatollah Khomeini's, fatwa's not the word I'm looking for, jihad warriors and the Soviet Union. It's like, I don't want either one of them to win. What I want to see in this show is I want to see our heroes, if indeed they are to be our heroes, destroy the government of Earth and bring it down to its knees, crumbling into the dust that it deserves to be, because they are scum who need to end. And I just cannot sympathize with these people. They're awful, and we're supposed to like them.
Yes, I was thinking about a similar point, which is the best, especially that Orwellian in vitro facility. And it was, and these are supposed to be the good guys, huh?
Right. You're showing us from Orwell. We're supposed to learn from Orwell that this is bad, that that's a system that has to be destroyed, not that these are the people running the good guys. I mean, I realize you can not be complicit in the crimes of your government, but if all you are is somebody who just tolerates it and goes on, then you are complicit. And there is no evidence that, apart from some words of, oh, you know, you're just people too, Tank. Like, there is no evidence here that there's a great indignity for them creating a race of super killers to be slaves. I think they wanted to tell us some things about our own government and our own problems, but I think by putting them in this context, they've missed the mark.
Yeah.
This is not the right story to tell this in. And the fact that the Chigs are kind of this sort of, well, we don't know what they're saying, we don't know what they're doing, we don't know where they live, and we don't know why they're doing this. And like, my sympathy would be with the Chigs, but I don't know what it is about what we've seen, but something just makes me think that they're jihadists. And I'm not sympathizing with that either. Certainly they aren't nice, you know, I mean, apart from that one Christmas episode, but by and large. Yeah, I don't know.
My only other note is that episode 13 is Level of Necessity.
It is indeed, and that is what we will be looking at next time. Kenneth, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. You've been listening to Fusion Patrol. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll consider supporting us at buymeacoffee.com/fusionpatrol or patreon.com/fusionpatrol. For our monthly Patreon subscribers, we're currently running a special series on Babylon 5. Come join the conversation and find other content at fusionpatrol.com. And we're back on social media, where you can also follow us on Mastodon and the Fediverse. Our address is podcast@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. This has been a Lone Locust production. On the next episode of Fusion Patrol, we will be looking at the 9th episode of Season 3 of Bugs, entitled Identity Crisis.
When we discuss how a good episode can be diminished by the arc that sets it up, the emptiness of the Bugs universe, and we get nostalgic about Zip and Bernoulli drives.
Come join the conversation on Fusion Patrol.